The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics.
This week's episode is sponsored by Newgate.
Hello and welcome to Polling Politics. I'm Joe Twyman, the political pollster.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
So we're back.
Woo!
Marie, one or two things have happened since we've had our short break in between series, our hiatus, our recess. Obviously, there's this whole thing about the epic battle over leadership and who has the right to rule. As far as you're concerned, who was right to sit on the Iron Throne?
So I stopped watching Game of Thrones a long time ago because turns out, you know, people just keep dying, which is not that fun. So no, I don't care about that. And I also didn't watch Love Island. So it's not been a very fun time for me personally, TV-wise.
If you haven't watched Love Island or Game of Thrones while we've been away, what have you done?
Oh, I started boxing, so that's very exciting. I've been finishing my book, which is also, you know, less exciting, to be honest, but still good. So I will be able to physically fight anyone who doesn't like the book.
Both end with you sweating and crying in a corner, presumably.
Jesus Christ, it's good to be back.
Yes, it is good to be back. And thank you for coming back. Remember, if you've enjoyed this podcast, do tell everyone, literally everyone, and pass on.
Also, sweating and crying while you're doing it would be really good.
The hashtag sweating and crying.
On literally that note, I cannot believe I can do a segue on this. But a friend and I came up with this theory that all politicians can be arranged along a sweaty and crying axis. So every politician is, to an extent, you know, sweating a bit or crying a lot or etc. And it's a really useful way to...
Can you give us examples? Can you give the listeners at home examples of this?
Okay, so fine. For example, I'd say Rory Stewart is probably crying but not sweaty. Michael Gove is crying and sweating. Jeremy Hunt, unclear. I think crying a bit but not sweating at all in a way that's a bit weird. Because, you know, they don't have to be physically sweaty or crying. It's just, you know, the kind of image of them and personality-wise. Oh, Theresa May. Ooh, that's a tough one. I think somehow neither.
Oh, I would have said both.
Really? Well,
And we can explore this in more detail over the next few weeks.
That's what I've been up to. See, you're sweaty and not crying.
Since we've been away, people have started to notice who Rory Stewart is. He was one of the also-rans in the leadership contest. Unfortunately, no success for Alan Mack, at least this time around.
I was so happy I managed to Mack someone yesterday. So this is an ongoing game I have with some friends in Westminster, where if Alan Mack walks into a room and you're the first person to notice them, you have to say to someone, oh my God, like, don't turn around right now, but the future PM has just arrived. And then if they actually turn around and realise who it is, you've Macked them. And I got it yesterday. I hadn't Macked anyone in a while. I was very happy.
How's the Alan Mack blanket?
I don't know what to do with it. It's still in my room. I still worry that one day, you know, someone will come round and be like, oh, what's in that bag? And I'll be like, you cannot look in the bag.
My sister can relate to this because I bought her an even larger blanket of similar type, but just with my face on it.
You're literally the worst. It gets better.
It gets better. I then printed in big letters on this blanket all her contact details, her address, her name, and her mobile phone number, so she cannot give it away or give it to charity or anything like that. She has to keep it.
If I were your sister, I would genuinely deeply resent you ever being born.
I think my sister does really resent me being born. But never mind. She's only very small, so barely gets noticed. Our guest today is the journalist Sebastian Payne. Hello, Seb.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
I am good.
Happy birthday, Seb.
Thank you very much. No better way to spend my 30th than talking about politics, Brexit, and Jeremy Hunt.
I'm glad you agree. Seb is Whitehall correspondent for the Financial Times. He's previously written for The Spectator and The Daily Telegraph, and you covered the US midterm elections for The Washington Post. But what I'm really interested in is your BSc in computer science.
I know, I did a proper job once upon a time.
This is remarkable. So what led to the jump from computer science
from one kind of nerd to another kind of nerd?
Obviously all on the nerd nerd spectrum. First of all, I wasn't very good at computer science, which is, as anyone who was on my course with me could attest to.
If you were on Seb's course, please do tweet us tweet us in using the hashtag sweaty and crying. Using the hashtag sweaty and crying.
I think the second reason as well was that I'd spent 3 years doing this degree, and computer science is just maths on steroids, really. You can actually do most of the degree without actually touching a computer. Some guy at my university did do that just to prove a point, which shows you all you need to know about computer scientists.
And all you need to know about Durham University.
Exactly. There were two women on the course, to be fair. Two whole women.
Out of how many?
About 150. So...
So it was very progressive.
Absolutely. But I think the main reason was that I'd spent 3 years doing this, and obviously, in a way, writing and coding are very similar in terms of trying to express ideas in a succinct way, trying to be clever about how you say things, and trying to not just do the same things everyone else has already done. But it was just people, like, you know, I know all jobs inevitably are just staring at a computer screen, but computer science has that to sort of 100%, whereas I wanted to do something that was just a lot more about people, and journalism and political journalism seemed the best way to do it.
And you're famous for your driving of very small cars at election campaigns. Tell us about that.
So this began during... So when I worked at the Washington Post, they just sent reporters out everywhere. This is what happens when you have a huge newspaper with a lot of budget. They just send you off on a plane to go and cover stuff. And I found it was a brilliant way of doing political journalism. And I was like, people in Westminster never leave Westminster. So why don't I just go and do that? So I invested all my savings in buying a 20-year-old Mini Cooper in 2015, still paying that off. And it was, as a car, an unmitigated disaster because the roof didn't fit properly. Over the winter of 2015, the floor went full Fred Flintstone and disappeared. And it broke down frequently, including once with Nigel Farage in the car and many other people. I think Sajid Javid came in the car, actually, as well, in Harlow in Essex. Anyway.
What an amazing metaphor for British politics. Marie, have you ever driven a Mini?
I mean, Joe, you've known me for how long? Do you really think I can drive?
No, I was being generous. But have you ever been in a Mini? One of the old school Minis?
I have not.
You're missing out. They are small. It's like a go-kart because...
That is a complete lie. You are not missing out at all. They are dreadful, dreadful
Joe,
cars.
Is that just because you happen to be quite tall, so you just have to take up the entire space of the Mini?
My grandma still talks about the time that she saw my brother, who's the same size as I am, and I, driving round the corner, both in a Mini. We don't do them in our family.
They are quite small, and they do break down a lot, and they are quite expensive, but they look great.
And so you replace that one with a Morris Minor next time around.
That's actually not mine. That belongs to a very nice chap called Steve in Derbyshire. So when we had the Snap 2017 general election, the FT video desk were like, oh, Seb, you must do a road trip. Last time we did a Mini, this time why don't you get like a Morris Minor? So I was like, okay. So I then went off and joined the Morris Minors Owner Club. Great people. And I put a post.
Right, you're sounding like Donald Trump. Great people. The best people.
The best people, particularly Steve. So I put a message on their internet forum and said, I'm looking to borrow a Morris Minor for the period of this election. Has anyone got one? And got some interesting offers, some cars that looked as if they had not been touched since about 1957. Steve was a lovely man, said, I have two. Why don't you come up to my farmhouse and choose which one you'd like to borrow? So I went up to visit him.
Turned out he wasn't a serial killer.
He wasn't. And I borrowed the red one, the Traveller, which was beautifully refurbished. He'd spent 10 years refurbishing it, and I drove it around the country. I think the two low points were, first of all, it used to be parked at the FT's office in the small car park because no one has cars in London anymore, and that is also the intake for the building's air conditioning system. And because the car's quite old, you have a thing called a choke. So when a car is, you're looking, Marie, you have no idea what I'm talking about.
A choke to our younger listeners,
which is that when a car engine starts, it's cold. So you have to put extra fuel in to warm it up. Now, on modern cars, there's a little computer that does that. On a Morris Minor, you have to do it manually with your hands. You have to pull the choke out and then push it in as the car warms up.
I don't care.
The end of this story was I had left the choke out for far too long.
Oh, so problematic.
Very problematic, particularly when that means it's putting out a very, very high quantity of carbon monoxide into the intake valve for the Financial Times. So I almost gassed the whole FT for about until they realised what had happened. And then second of all, it broke down on a housing estate in Hackney on the way back from Whitstable. And I had to get it towed all the way through London, but they couldn't tow it properly because there was no tow bar, so we had to use rope.
Amazing. So we'll come on to discuss the likelihood of a general election before the end of the year. But if that does happen, what's on your list of cars for next time around?
My God, must we talk about cars that much?
Well, I actually have a text from the fomented Steve, who just completely out of the blue, who said, "Good afternoon, Seb. It's Steve Clemerson here. You borrowed my Morris Minor. Just thinking, in the event of another election this year, would you fancy use of a VW Beetle I've just done up? Trust all is well."
Is this a scoop?
Absolute scoop.
Fantastic. You heard it here first, guys. It's a VW Beetle for the upcoming election. Since we've been off, the stories that have been dominating the headlines are the stories that dominate the headlines this week. It's Brexit and it's the Tory leadership. Seb, I want to start with you. Who would have been your choice for Tory leadership?
Probably Michael Gove, and that's not just because I look like him, as people on Twitter like to point out very frequently. You can make your own judgments, people in this room, of whether this is true.
You do have Michael Gove glasses.
I think I can just see the glasses, not the rest, but...
But moving on from the glasses...
Oh my God, okay, just side note, actually, this is more important. When I had my hair blonde, everyone said I looked like Amber Rudd, so there is very bad Edinburgh show I think we could work on.
My thought about Michael Gove was that, look, regardless of this contest, which has already descended into false promises, chasing unicorns, howling at the moon, choose whatever metaphor you like about the state of Brexit.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Well, it is a bad thing because we've got this huge existential thing facing our country. Everyone's just talking complete rubbish at the moment. Whatever you say about Michael Gove, he's someone who does do detail. He's someone who does actually understand what Brexit is. And he's not somebody who's just going to go headfirst into a no-deal Brexit and say it's all going to be fine because patriotism. So I thought out of all the candidates, he was probably best first to do that. But of course, when we look back at the contest, those allegations about his past life, particularly his use of drugs in his younger days, completely set it off course. And he never recovered from that moment. But he did come very close to make it into the final two. There was a lot of backroom horse dealing on the vote, but if two MPs had changed their minds a different way, we'd be looking at Boris Johnson versus Michael Gove, and I personally think that contest would be quite different to the one we're seeing with Jeremy Hunt.
That would have been a much more interesting contest. I completely agree. I think the way also like Michael Gove can get under Boris's skin in a way that Jeremy Hunt absolutely cannot. So he kind of feels at the moment they're kind of running, you know, two campaigns in two separate rooms, and occasionally they remember the other exists and that sort of it. Whereas I think Gove Boris would have been more interesting, and Boris would have been more challenged as well. At the moment, you know, he's just kind of coasting, really.
The polling is really interesting on this because it shows consistently how important Brexit is to Conservative Party members. And there's been polling recently saying that they would prioritise Brexit over keeping Scotland in the Union or keeping peace in Northern Ireland or keeping the economy healthy and all these sorts of things. And you can question whether that polling is just people saying that or whether they really believe it. But what's interesting to me is that if it had been Michael Gove, we would have had a contest where Michael Gove was saying, "I am the true believer in Brexit. Boris Johnson is the fair weather supporter." Whereas now we have a contest where Boris Johnson says, "I am the true believer in Brexit. Jeremy Hunt is the fair weather supporter." And that, I think, puts a completely different spin on it.
I agree with that. At the moment, you're seeing Jeremy Hunt acting like a Union Jack shopping trolley at the moment, just going from side to side, saying one thing on Brexit, no deal would be disaster, it would be political suicide for the Tory party. Then he had this speech I went to this week to launch his no deal Brexit offering, and it had six MPs there. And every single one of them said to me, "I will not vote for a no deal Brexit." You know, people like Patrick McLaughlin, Margot James, Philip Dunn, Alan Duncan, all these people who really don't want a no-deal Brexit, and they're backing Jeremy Hunt because they don't want a no-deal Brexit. Then they then sat and clapped along as Jeremy Hunt gave a whole speech about his 10-point plan to deal with a no-deal Brexit. And I think throughout this contest, he's desperately trying not to be Theresa in trousers, or the tit, as has been put forward by some people.
When you say some people, do you mean you?
I don't just mean mean, I mean supporters of other leadership candidates. Many are available. Whereas at the moment, Jeremy Hunt is constantly trying to prove to Conservative MPs and members, "I believe in Brexit. I think Brexit is wonderful. Please trust me to do Brexit." Whereas, as you said, Joe, if it had been Michael Gove, he could have said, "I literally led the Vote Leave campaign." And, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg said to me for a piece I've got coming out this weekend's FT, "We always knew Brexit was going to need compromises." I'm pretty sure they didn't say that, but never mind. They said Brexit's always going to need compromises, and you need to have a Brexiter to sell it. And I think that is the problem with Jeremy Hunt, as we've seen over the past couple of weeks. Whatever happens, he's still going to have this issue. As soon as he starts to talk about any kind of compromise, any kind of deal, the ERG, the Eurosceptics will all come back on him and say, you didn't believe this, you never believed in it, you're just as bad as Mrs. May.
But isn't there the issue as well, which I think, you know, is something Theresa May struggled with, of because she was a Remainer, of kind of like accidentally, like trying to prove her Brexit credentials, but that way just going way too far. And I think the Lancaster House speech, where she just tied her hands, you know, in the worst possible way, was kind of proof of that. And I think that Hunt is kind of what he's doing, like no deal as well. So you end up having those former Remainers just trying so hard to prove their credentials that they just go way too far like that way and sort of, you know, because they're kind of trying to show they've got the deal of the convert. So, you know, no, I think that, you know, that's the issue. And we're having exactly the same with Hunt at the moment in the campaign. He just keeps sort of, you know, and I think that's something weirdly he does quite a lot. Like I find him really fascinating because I think Jeremy Hunt will be sort of like very, very dull. And then once every sort of like 3 months, normally he'll just say something completely mad. And out of characters, what was it when he called the EU the USSR, I think, or compared to the Soviet Union.
And his abortion views as well, which came completely out of nowhere on a Sky News interview, which he said, I wouldn't want to seek to reduce the limit from 24 to 12 weeks. But he just came out with this. And it was like, is this Jeremy Hunt? You know, the kind of moderate Cameroon, slightly awkward former businessman who's got these kind of views. I just don't get what Jeremy Hunt is about.
He's a former businessman, you say. Has that come up at all during the campaign?
Yeah. Has he done some deals?
I've chatted to a few civil servants who've worked in his departments, and they just did not like him at all for the reason that they said, you know, we have no idea what he's about. Even as people kind of working for him, you know, kind of mid-ranking civil servants, they're like, we have no idea what makes Jeremy Hunt tick. We don't know what policy areas he's particularly sort of like passionate about. Like, he was really hard to work for because he's really, really hard to read. So if even the people who worked for him feel that, I think that, you know, what hope is there for the rest of us?
He's obviously a good manager. Like, he ran the Department of Health, which is, you know, one of the worst white horde departments to get your heads around. And how he dealt with the junior doctor strike, I think even he would say was not a great success. But in terms of running the Department of Health through huge budget constraints, I think he was quite successful on that front. So being very technocratic and managerial is good, but it's not what the Conservative Party wants. And I don't really think it's what the country wants. Because if you look at British prime ministers, you always have a bit of a seesaw from a very charismatic, energetic person to a kind of duller managerial type, going from Margaret Thatcher to John Major, Tony Blair to Gordon Brown, David Cameron to Theresa May. And so that seesaw, clearly we're feeling we're going to that point where you want somebody who's great on the rhetoric, great on saying lots of flowery language, and whether that actually achieves anything, we'll have to wait and see.
We're joined now by Simon Gentry, who leads the public affairs practice at Newgate. Hello, Simon.
Hi.
Now, we would like to talk today about Neil Woodford and the whole debacle over the Woodford Investment Fund. Now, this man he's not George Bailey, is he? Perhaps you could explain a bit about what's happened.
He's not. So Neil Woodford was one of these star managers in the city running investment funds for people. And he had something called patient capital, which basically means you invest for a very long time. The fact is that people took fright. The performance dipped a little bit and people took fright and tried to take the money out really quickly. And because it's not that kind of fund, there was a problem. So the fund was closed. The interesting thing about this is that it's going to drive a whole lot of regulatory change. And the timing is interesting because at the moment we've got the UK sort of imminently about to exit the EU, and there's beginning to be thought about how the regulatory environment will change once that happens. And so we can imagine a situation where the UK suddenly has freedom to regulate its financial services in quite a different way. The city's woken up to this and begin to think about post-October how you might restructure financial regulation in a way that is perhaps more suitable to the UK environment.
There's been a lot of discussion about Neil Woodford being this star of investments and his ability in picking good stocks. Was there truth in that to begin with, or was it just luck? And if there was truth, do you think he's now lost his touch, or is he just going through a bad patch?
No, for many years he was an outstanding investment manager. He picked really, really well, and people made money, and there was huge confidence in him. I think it looks at the kind of, you begin to think about the whole sort of star system that sometimes develops in the city, and that's something which we all should reflect on, because everybody goes through periods in which they invest very well, and then some periods where they don't do so well. The point was that it was a patient capital fund, so it was supposed to be over a long term, and there was this mismatch between people who sort of some kind of savings accounts and other people who sort of something that you might invest for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And there's sort of a mismatch between people's expectations.
And whose fault is that, that there's a mismatch? Is that mis-selling? Is that misinterpretation?
No, I don't think there was any mis-selling. I think, frankly, there is some fault in terms of the people making the investments. They see these as short-term investments, like a savings account, and they're not. These things are for long-term investing.
And so what should be the regulatory response then?
Well, clearly, there will have to be some response. And you see Andrew Bailey, who wants to be the governor of the Bank of England, feels he will have to do something. We don't know what he will do, but Nicky Morgan and the Treasury Select Committee are looking into it. I think there will have to be an environment in which people will have a clearer sense of what they're investing in, and that fund managers will have greater flexibility. It may be that the directive that underpins all of this will have to be adjusted, and we can't do that at the moment because of the European situation. But once we're out, if we ever leave, we'll have to see, you know, what the regulatory response looks like.
So Neil Woodford is still charging management fees of around 100k a day on funds he's running. Is that morally right?
Well, I don't know if it's morally right or wrong, but the fact is that the fund needs to make an income in order to, even if people are getting out of the fund or will need to get, the actual people working there who are managing the fund have to be paid. And so there is, again, a situation where if he wasn't being paid, then he wouldn't have any staff and the fund would collapse. And we don't want that to happen. The fact is, everybody's trying to effectively put the fund in a sort of runoff situation so that over time, people can all get their money back and be done in an orderly and managed way.
In polling terms, people quite often are supportive of regulation, of bankers, of banking products. Do you think that that is where we're headed?
Well, that's interesting. I think that the environment will change, clearly. Some of the things that the EU have wanted to do for a long time, Tobin taxes, capping bankers' pay, et cetera, that almost certainly will happen on the EU side. I think on the UK side, if we wish to remain competitive, in fact, we may have the opposite. We have actually have a deregulatory environment in order to make the city more attractive, in order to continue to attract investment from around the world.
One final question about money then, Simon. If you saw a wallet on the ground, And you picked it up and it had money in it, would you return that wallet?
I absolutely would. And the reason I would, because it happened to me recently and I'm incredibly grateful to the person who handed the wallet in.
And what percentage of the world, because this is an international survey, what do you think the world figure is for people that would hand it in, a wallet with money?
70%.
Well, we'll find out if you're right at the end of the show. Simon Gentry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We should, of course, talk about Boris Johnson. He is the person that won the vote for the MPs. He's the person that leads the polling of Conservative members by some distance. And he's also, although the polling on this is far less clear-cut, the most popular among the general public. Seb, I've got three questions for you. Do you think Boris Johnson should be Prime Minister? Do you think Boris Johnson can be Prime Minister? And do you think Boris Johnson will be Prime Minister?
So on the should question, we are still in a parliamentary democracy and the Conservative Party does have a majority in Parliament, just about. It's getting smaller.
With the DUP.
Yeah, it's getting smaller literally every week at the moment. But I think in that basis, given what we were talking about Brexit versus non-Brexit, it kind of feels to me that this is Boris's moment. Now, he could be Prime Minister for a very short period of time, which comes on to your next question, because can he be Prime Minister? The big question about Boris is when he was Mayor of London, he was very effective by having a great team around him. He had a very effective Chief of Staff, a guy called Sir Eddie Lister. He had Deputy Mayors in Kit Malthouse, now an MP, James Cleverly, now an MP. And lots of people I've spoken to said that the way that worked was Boris set the tone, set the agenda, allowed Eddie Lister to actually deliver the policies, and allowed each of the areas just to get on and do their thing. So if Boris chooses an effective cabinet and works in that chairman kind of style, maybe that can work. I don't know. But if Boris Johnson goes in and runs number 10 like he ran the Foreign Office, then it can't work.
But I think on that note as well, the issue he's going to have is that, you know, when you see, and you know, at the moment we're kind of going through the sugar tax, you know, so like row, that shows, you know, obviously he said he's against it and he kind of wants to, you know, kind of reverse it. But he's got people like Matt Hancock on his, like, and on, quite close to him on his team, and who obviously, you know, were massively in favour of that. Like, he isn't his tent too wide, I think, is the problem that's going to be. And, you know, and kind of seeing as well people on his campaign clearly freelancing and kind of, you know, being like, Team Boris, think that. So, you know, the kind of story was in the Telegraph splash a few days ago on, was it like cutting the number of departments and cabinet ministers by half? And then Team Boris the next day kind of saying absolutely not. And also because I remember I was at a speech Liz Truss gave at some event in December where she kept talking about how, you know, drastically reducing the size of Whitehall. And it's like, I don't want to say that was definitely her, but it's like, oh, what a coincidence that, you know, someone quite close to Boris just quite likes a policy and then the Telegraph did it and then Team Boris had to be like, nope. So that, how do you, I think, how can you run that kind of effective team as he did in City Hall if, you know, you've got a tent that's too wide and also with everyone kind of doing their own thing?
I think you've nailed the exact problem with Boris is going to face there, Marie, because there's three tribes of Boris supporters at the moment in Westminster. There are the Long Marchers. Those are people who've supported Boris's candidacy since the coalition years. So you're talking people like Conor Burns, Nadine Dorries, Jake Berry. There's some of them are ministers, some of them are whips, but at the moment they're organising Boris's campaign. They are generally quite socially conservative as well. They also tend to represent provincial seats, the kind of leave voting constituencies. They're all hard Brexiters. The second tribe is then the City Hall gang, who are the ones we just talked about, who are probably Boris's, I think, favourite people. It's quite hard to say, but I think those are the ones he feels most comfortable. And those are generally all metropolitan liberals. They're very relaxed about immigration. They're quite relaxed about the size of the state. You know, because if you look at London, Boris, you know, nationalised the overground. He ran the bike scheme that was all out of City Hall. So if you look at the size of the state in terms of London, it actually grew quite a lot in the 8 years Boris was mayor. Then the third tribe of Boris supporters are the new recruits. That's people like Gavin Williamson, Grant Shapps, and if I was not being too unkind, there are a lot of people whose careers we thought had come to an end and have found a new lease of life under Boris Johnson. Those three tribes all got completely conflicting policy ideas, and Boris will probably do what he always does, trying to keep everybody happy, because remember, his motivation is to be liked. So his Downing Street, his cabinet will probably have people from all three of those tribes, all Team Boris, as you put them, and how you knit that together, I honestly don't know. And I think the sugar tax is a prime example of how the Long Marchers conflict with the City Haller type people in Boris's team. And he's going to have to decide quite quickly how he's going to govern on this, because if he doesn't, it's all just going to get pulled apart incredibly quickly.
And then, of course, there are implications for the national picture. And so you guys are focusing on the what's happening in inside politics. But Boris Johnson has tried to pull the same trick with the electorate, and there are different segments of the electorate that that he appeals to. And how you then win over those people once you have to come down on one side or another and you can no longer pull this trick of whatever you think, I agree with you, then it gets really difficult, particularly as, of course, with Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister, the arithmetic of the House of Commons does not change. And Europe's position potentially does not change either.
I just don't see how we get through this year without an election, because the Conservative majority, assuming the DUP are kept happy throughout this whole process, is going to be about 3 in August. We're pretty much going to get a confidence vote in the government in early September. And whatever Brexit policy Boris tries to do, there's just no way through the Commons here. And, you know far better than I do, Joe, but all those kind of Remain-y city seats the Tories have had, Putney is one, Chingford, Ian Duncan-Smith, Theresa Villiers, and, oh, Boris Johnson, Uxbridge is a very good point, what he's going to do about that. Those seats look as if, to me, they would just go in a general election this year, because there's a lot of Remain supporters in those seats. And regardless of which way Boris tries to govern, you're not going to win back those Remain supporters if the Conservatives are fighting an election on Brexit.
And the specific type of Brexit could be damaging to his Leave support as well, because when you ask Leave voters what they want from Brexit, you have a proportion of people that say that they want EU citizens' rights to be maintained in this country, and that's about half of Leave voters.
But what? Then you
sorry, Marie, it's about half of Leave
it's
voters.
It's only what?
Look, it gets worse. Around about a third of Leave voters say that they want EU citizens to be sent home. So how
a
you
third.
A third? It's about 29%. So how you reconcile those completely opposite positions, which are all covered under the tent of Leave voters, I would say that's an impossible political task when it comes to the electorate.
But I think that's been, for me, in a weird way, the sort of like main story of the Tory leadership contest, especially when we're kind of looking at all the candidates. It was such a stark reminder that there is no way forward for Brexit. But, you know, I can't remember when it was, but I had a proper sort of like sinking feeling at some point where I was like, oh my God, you know, just being reminded that there's no majority in the House of Commons for anything. We know the withdrawal agreement is not being reopened. We know the backstop is not going to change in any meaningful way. We know there's not going to be no Brexit or a second referendum, or, you know, like, we've basically tried all the options and none of them are working. And it was such a, you know, it's not a novel point to make, but I think it's kind of been brought back. And so, you know, there's no obvious way forward at all.
I think the fundamental thing that Leave politicians have never reconciled themselves the fact was that the Vote Leave campaign was very liberal in the sense that they actually wanted more immigration. I remember watching a Boris Johnson speech where he said, I'm pro-immigrant, I want more immigration, but we want controls. All of the politicians involved, that be it Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, or even Douglas Carswell, they had this kind of liberal view of things. They have never accepted they won that off the back of some very illiberal views in the country, that a vast majority of Leave voters don't support the same kind of Brexit they want. And they've never been willing to accept that. And going back to your point earlier, Marie, about Remainers trying to, you know, overcompensate for being Remainers as well, what Theresa May did was she said, look, this referendum is about money and it's about migration. And her deal at least spoke to those two things. It was hated by leavers in Westminster because that was not what it was about for them. For them, it was about sovereignty and laws and the size of that kind of thing. And I feel that conversation is going to have to take place. Maybe it happens in a general election in some form.
49% want continued rights to remain for EU citizens living in the UK. 29% want EU citizens living in the UK to leave the country.
I am genuinely gobsmacked. Like, I did not know that stat. Gobsmacked.
Well, that's a survey from Delta Poll from March this
well,
year.
Well, not thanks.
and somebody's going to have to lead on this because, you know, I find those numbers horrific. Like, that is a really bad thing for our country to have that number of people seeing that. But somebody in number 10, somebody is going to have to say, this is why EU citizens are a wonderful thing for our country, both in terms of the culture, the economy, and not just people like Marie who's staring at me at the moment. But it is a real problem. And I just think we're at this point that we're pretty much ungovernable. Well, as a country for the foreseeable future.
What the polls don't tell us is how important each of those issues are to the people that that agree with it. And so it may be that...
Someone should have pulled that.
The situation is more complicated, so any leader, whoever it has to be, will have to hope that their leadership on that issue can bring people around, and those people that oppose it, they don't oppose it strongly enough. But it's certainly a difficult area. On the plus side, 47% want the return of blue passports.
Oh, get fucked.
I have to get a new passport, and I don't know whether to get one now to get one of the last red ones or just accept the inevitable, the blue ones are coming. Or I could just get the Daily Express's blue passport cover, which you collect tokens for.
I respect that. That's, you know what?
I've not been collecting tokens, just to clarify on that.
Okay. Seb, imagine you found a wallet on the ground which contained contact details for the owner and some money in it. Would you return that wallet?
I would try to.
And what percentage of Britain do you think would return?
Probably less than half.
Less than half? What's your percentage guess?
I'm going to go maybe 45%.
Marie, what do you think?
I've already actually seen the stats, so I'm going to...
Don't give it away!
No, but this is good, because I can sort of like say something that's close to the truth, but also not the exact truth. So I'm going to say maybe 53%.
Well, of the countries that were included in the survey, the average was 51%. So 51% would return it. And Britain is round about there. It depends whether it has money in it or not, actually. If it has money in, around 60% would return it. If it doesn't have money in, only fewer than one in four would.
But if you've got a wallet with a contactless card, you can just spend lots of £20. Or 30
just
pounds.
Have a nice day, yeah, and then return it at the
lots
end.
Lots and lots of prets.
Yeah, it's remarkable. This isn't actually a poll. This was actually an experiment that was run. 17,000 dummy wallets were produced with a little bit of money in and contact details, and they were left strategically all over the world by the team that conducted this. This survey cost $600,000. I don't know how it was paid for. It was written up in the journal Science. So, well, which country do you think was most likely to return the wallet?
Which is a happy, friendly sort of community? Canada.
Canada was actually pretty much in the middle. Marie, what do you think?
I mean, I also know.
I'm going to stop asking you questions if you're going to give away.
Well, yeah, just don't shame me.
Seb, back to you. If think of a happy country. Think of one that Donald Trump might always refer to.
America.
Other than America. America, actually.
Mexico.
Think of a country where everyone's loaded, so they would have no reason to pick up money in a wallet.
Switzerland.
Correct. Switzerland. Switzerland. Stop.
Actually, did Donald Trump talk about
with
Switzerland?
The Donald Trump thing, I was going with Norway, who are in second place. He always uses Norway as an example.
Does he?
Yeah, he says, think about immigrants coming from Norway. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, yeah, when he means white people.
Yes, yeah, he uses that. It's his go-to for white liberals. UK and US, pretty close to one another. We're sort of bottom of the middle section, but China, Malaysia and the UAE were at the bottom, the least likely to return the wallets.
France, not that bad. I feel really uncharitable now, but yeah, I really thought France would be laid out.
France and Germany leading the non-Nordic and Swiss European countries. Czech Republic and Poland both up there as well, but Sweden, Norway, Netherlands, Switzerland.
Didn't you, all the boring countries?
I don't think it's boring to return something with money. And this is once you control for the income that the countries have, their GDP, and all the other variations in the study.
How much of it is about the wealth of the country versus the social attitude of the country? Is there any correlation there?
Yes, there is. And you can read all about that in Science Journal if you're willing to download and read the PDF, which I have to say, I was not. Seb, I think that's all for today. Thank you very much for coming in. Please do tell everyone about our podcast and indeed your own podcast.
FT Politics, available every Saturday morning on iTunes.
So what else would you be doing on a Saturday morning other than listening to Seb? Seb, thanks very much for coming in. It's been great talking to you on Polling Politics. And thanks also to Newgate for our new sponsors. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.